what makes a man to roam? What makes a man leave bed and board and turn his back on home? Ride away.
Released in the United Kingdom on the 21st of September 1956, the John Ford opus The Searchers is the subject of the latest Culture Shapers, in which we're delighted to welcome to the podcast the amazingly talented director Phil Leonis to share his views on a film which has been reappraised so many times, and even though it didn't necessarily do tremendously spectacularly well upon its original release, it's been viewed from various lenses from the point of view of it's totally racist, or it's John Ford getting in touch with the American myth, or its mythologies, and so on. Welcome, Phil Leonis, to share with us over the next 30 or 40 minutes or so some thoughts on the 1956 adventure, drama, and, of course, Western, The Searchers.
Well, thanks for having me back, Alex. It's certainly thrilling to get to discuss this film. It's humbling to get to discuss it. I mean, it is such a landmark, not only in film history and in film production, and we'll talk about the way it influenced so many filmmakers, not only in the Western genre, but obviously throughout the second half of the 20th century, but also the way it influenced critical analysis of film, film theory. John Ford being one of those figures who worked in the studio system, who famously said, "My name is John Ford, I make Westerns," though of course he made many great films that were not Westerns, but who was reappraised, among others, by Cahiers du Cinéma, and with the development of the auteur theory, because he was a man who simply, if we can use that word, directed. He did not necessarily write or produce his films, and yet there is such an authorial through line in terms of the themes that he deals with. And although I don't think that every director who makes a film is the film's author, I do believe, because sometimes, after all, the driving force behind a movie is a producer. Sometimes it's a writer. Sometimes it's a producer star. But if there are, if there is an authorial stamp on a film, it is usually best expressed through the director, because the director is the one person who has an impact on every single facet of the production and the finished film. And so John Ford, quite a giant for both filmmakers and for film theorists and film critics.
And somebody who certainly, as far as the cinematic notion of the art of cinema, really probably arguably the biggest art form of the 20th century. I mean, we look at clearly in the Soviet Union, the classic line that Lenin said, "Give me control of Hollywood, we'll actually convert the world to communism," sort of easily viewed very much as a propagandist tool, and indeed had film factories. You know, the idea was that you would produce film on that kind of regular, almost classic production line format. I mean, I always find it fascinating that the director you mentioned, John Ford, shares his name with Henry Ford, of course, no relation, but clearly the machinist and the line of producing stuff. But there are a number of areas.
So I would think thematically John Ford would be the antithesis of Henry Ford, the idea of the assembly line, because John Ford certainly does champion the individual. But I am amused, you know, to think about that, about, you know, if the communists had been able, and of course there was so much fear at this time, even when, or shortly before The Searchers coming out, and so many other Westerns. We're going to talk about some of the subtextual meanings, you know, that have been applied to The Searchers. But obviously in the years leading up to this, many films, especially Westerns, especially genre films, science fiction, Westerns like High Noon, But even mainstream dramas, like On the Waterfront, deal subtextually with the threat of communism, with the perceived threat of communism, and the reactions to this perceived threat. So it's funny to throw the Searchers into this mix. And, of course, from a contemporary standpoint, I think there's many people in our country here in the United States who believe that happened. And that communism is still alive and well in the film industry.
From a personal point of view, and part of the rationale of the Culture Shapers is to share personal viewpoints of this, I think I possibly must have seen the Searchers as a child, or dipped in and dipped out. First time I really kind of was made to sit down and watch it, though, was actually in my postgraduate work and reading an MA in Film and Television Studies at the University of London and the Institute of Education. And even then, I have to say, there was a part of me which kind of took a time to really appreciate what was happening here. I mean, yes, one can look at the opening sequence, one can look at the simplicity of the shots, you can see the structure of the characters, the way the narrative develops. But I'd also describe this in many ways as a slow burner, which might seem a bit ironic given the kind of the scope of the film, but the more you actually view the Searchers, and I must have seen it now probably about a dozen times in kind of genuinely looking at it, and it does repay repeated viewings purely from the point of view of not only the views of Peter Bogdanovich, who was again an associate of John Ford and friend and again filmmaker in his own way, but his own perspectives on the simplicity and the elegance of Ford's shots and developments and the ways in which he wasn't somebody who as a director wanted take after take after take. Effectively, it was set the thing up. I mean, it's a wonderful line, Phil, that it still remains with me. It was a John Ford line that, well, he got lucky in terms of the viewpoints of that. And the Searchers, although it does have some studio settings, really kind of pushes that whole Western frontier vista to the max.
Well, there are some incredible soundstage sequences in this that are intercut with location footage, such as the scene leading up to the attack on the homestead at the beginning of the film. But I like that you say slow burn, because this is a movie that, even watching it this time, I was thinking, wow, do we have to take so much time at the Jorgensen's home while Laurie reads the letter? And then I realized, yes, this is what gives us a belief in the passage of time. And it is critically important, and I've faced this as a filmmaker, I faced this with my documentary The Truth Is Out There, that you have to give an audience the visceral experience of a great deal of time passing in what is compressed time. But you have to viscerally make them feel how much time has passed and the weight of this time so that they can appreciate the plight of the characters. And so some sequences like that really are masterful in how they create what you're describing as the slow burn, while at the same time this film is at times rippling with tension. I mentioned the suspense leading up to the attack, the suspense leading up to the end of the first act, the chase and the battle at the waterfront. I mean, wow, the way tension is built is incredible, and then it punctuates in this intense action, or in the case of the attack at the beginning, fear, just stark terror that is depicted, I think, more authentically there in The Searchers than had ever been. Fear had never been depicted so authentically prior to that point, and it's one of the reasons that I think this film is such an influence on David Lynch, who is one of the modern masters of really depicting what true stark terror looks and sounds like. But the slow build does allow for so much, but it is something, getting back to your personal statement, that I think it takes not only time to appreciate, but it takes context to appreciate. Until I got to the point where I had seen not only other John Ford films and not only other John Wayne films, but other Westerns and other films being made in a variety of genres at that time, I could not appreciate fully The Searchers. So even though, you know, there's so many lists, mine included, where The Searchers will end up on the, you know, top 10 films of all time or the greatest Western of all time, and if you're watching these movies sometimes from the top down of those lists, you miss the reason why these films resonate so deeply. You need to maybe build up towards the great ones, if that makes sense.
One of the interesting elements that you talked about, the influence on the David Lynch's work, I also think that for me, the classic sequence of The Homestead is directly echoed in George Lucas's Star Wars and
the Tatooine sequence. All the vistas on Tatooine.
Yeah. It
was really stunning to me to watch this, that there are shots, establishing shots of Tatooine, that I think directly reference. And of course, George Lucas has overtly called John Ford one of his influences, as did Coppola, as did Spielberg. Basically, any director with a beard in the 1970s. Scorsese remakes The Searchers as Taxi Driver. Paul Schrader remakes it as Hardcore. And right at the same time, George Lucas certainly uses as a direct influence and a template several shots for Tatooine, and then, yes, the attack on the homestead, and Luke's realization that while they've been lured away, his home might be under Imperial attack is, wouldn't it be fascinating to watch John Wayne's reaction as Ethan in The Searchers to realizing that there's one of two possibilities of why they were lured away by the Comanche pretending to be rustlers, and put that side by side with the moment where Luke realizes what has possibly happened. In my mind's eye, they're very similar, and that's not to say derivative, right? It's not. Here's where we get into this realm of copy and ripping off versus homage, because George Lucas is doing what John Ford and his colleagues did, which he is connecting deeply to the underpinning mythology that runs through all these stories. And so by sharing this kind of visual approach to it, you are paying a very nice homage that says all these stories are wading in the same mythological water. We may not be saying the same things, but we're exploring the same universal themes. And I think that that's really important, because it's something that, let's face it, made Star Wars accessible to people who thought, well, I don't like spaceship movies.
Fascinating if you consider the notion that when The Searchers was being filmed, it was merely 90 years, only 90 years after America had been tearing itself apart with the Civil War, you know, 1861, 1865. And here we have in 1956 the reflection back on Searchers. So there would have been still, you know, that kind of oral history memory of folk who remember that. And the reason I'm mentioning that, Phil, is because, you know, the character of Ethan Edwards, he's not your classic Wayne hero. He's not the Wayne of Stagecoach. He's not the John Wayne that effectively, you know, is the heroic thing. It's a brave choice, in a sense, for Wayne at this particular period in his career, almost as brave as perhaps John Ford, who is making this again when he himself is in his mid-50s. I mean, he'd worked on the silent era. He had effectively seen through, as indeed had John Wayne, of course, you know, they'd actually seen the growth of this strange, bizarre art form, you know, develop within the whole sort of sequence, become centered within the Hollywood scenario. And here we were, post-World War II, in the, you know, the height of the McCarthy era, but also the battle on a technical front, that this was a way in which cinema was competing with that upstart technology of the television set in terms of getting people to see the big screen and actually seeing, you know, movies in the fullest version. It was, again, probably that might have been one of the reasons why it was quite some time before I actually saw The Searchers in full, you know, in a big screen, obviously with DVDs and arrangements from that point of view. See on a TV screen, you think, what, particularly if you pan and scan, which again loses an awful lot of the shot composition, which really is at the heart of Wayne's work. I mean, he doesn't go mad with editing here. He doesn't have jump cuts all over the place. The pace and the tension grows naturally out of the shots.
It's a startling performance for John Wayne. It really is. He was never a great actor. He was a great star, and he is downright elemental in this film. And I am struck by, maybe, I don't know if it had influence on David Lean. David Lean had yet to go to the wild wide expanse of canvas of Bridge on the River Kwai, of Lawrence of Arabia at this point. So perhaps it did have an influence on him, but certainly this was in the zeitgeist of this move, as you're pointing out, financially to keep people from television. Let's give them widescreen vistas. But David Lean, like John Ford before him, were really rooted in stories of intimacy set against these epic mythological landscapes. And that's why people who have tried to emulate David Lean, they start with the scope. They don't realize that he started with the man. And so it's one of the most intimate pictures, Lawrence of Arabia. And I can't think of a John Wayne Western that is more intimate in terms of us getting to know the emotional reality of one of John Wayne's characters. His Ethan's emotions are incredibly available to us, even as the details of his life are kept incredibly mysterious. Maybe we can explore that a little bit, but I also would love to, you're talking about how little time had really passed when you think about the time between The Searchers is released and even the Civil War. I dare say there were people who were alive during the Civil War who were alive to see The Searchers, right?
Yeah.
And there might have been people who themselves had not put down the saber, as Ethan has not in it. But it's striking to me that American history, 1864, the Civil War is beginning to wind down. It's 100 years before we enact something called the Civil Rights Act in this country. In 1868, when The Searchers is set, it's an uneasy era of Reconstruction, where again, some men like Ethan were not going to lay down their saber. They'd given one oath, and they figured one oath was good enough for their lives. 100 years later in America, 12 years after The Searchers, we would have, you know, the most upheaval in an American year, probably in modern history, with Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy being killed. With the Chicago riots at the Democratic Convention, with at the same time the Apollo 8 mission and humans orbiting the Earth. So bring us back to this mythological idea of the role of the individual versus society. I loved, you know, you played the opening theme music, and I was really more struck by that song upon this viewing than I ever had been before. I'm also struck by the way those titles are simply against the adobe brick of what I guess we can assume is the homestead that Ethan returns to. And the song is singing and asking again and again, what makes a man wander? So even in the opening shots of these titles, we're told that the themes of this movie are the themes of a desire for home versus a man's need to wander. That the West is a place tamed by men for women to come and civilize, but that ultimately there is no place for the man that made civilization possible. This is the irony of the West. This is the tension of the opposites that only the West could contain. And by the time John Ford is getting around to telling this, it doesn't exist except as a place of mind. And what does it do culturally, societally, to a people if there is no place for these kind of men to wander?
And there is, again, a classic aspect of the script where the Jorgensens, Lars and Mrs. Jorgensen, obviously use the line, this country, and I think the response from Olive Carey as Mrs. Jorgensen is that it may need to be built on their own bones, which clearly is a nod in the direction of the then contemporary audience in the mid-1950s, post-World War II, pre-Vietnam, post-Korean conflict and so on, but still in a changing environment of seeing, you know, America's place in the world and so on. You mentioned characters and various, or music, I would actually say, and music and characters obviously in many ways work together. I think it's interesting that the line that seems to come out is that John Ford probably didn't want as much music in this film as originally emerged. I don't think he was a huge fan, by all accounts, of actually having music unless it had a specific reason and rationale within that. Two things to sort of consider, Phil. I mean, first of all, a little nod in the movie trivia scenario that it was interesting to see that the young Debbie Edwards was played by Lana Wood, and of course her sister Natalie Wood, late Natalie Wood, played Debbie Edwards that we come to see later on in the film, and the whole aspect within that. But I'm going to play you a short little clip, 25 seconds literally, from Max Steiner's soundtrack to this, and I wonder if you can actually identify which character cue this is designed to actually bring on board. He's certainly one of my favourite characters from The Searchers. Do you need any clues, or have you already nailed it?
Is that the introduction? I think it was the introduction at the sequence I was speaking of before, where Charlie arrives with the letter to the Jorgensen?
No, actually. I'll give you a clue. Rocking chair. I just want my rocking chair.
It's Hank Worthy
exactly.
as Mose.
Hank Worthy as Mose Harper. Again, a character who initially think, who, what? And yet somehow a strange voice of sanity, because you know we come across this notion that for many ways we have the Martin Powley character, who is the crossbreed, the half-breed, the person who's never fully acknowledged from that perspective. He acts as the voice of reason, but in his own way, you know, Mose's commitment to only tell Marty, not, you know, his kind of suspicion of Ethan. Here's somebody who's clearly been wounded by his own experiences, but I think the performance, that, and again, all of the cast in so many ways, and we know that many of them had worked with John Ford before, Ward Bond, you know, a regular coming in so many ways, in this particular instance, the role of Reverend Captain Samuel Johnson Clayton. But I thought Mose Harper, for me, it's partly comedy relief. I mean, if we're using a Star Wars routine, you could say almost a kind of R2-D2-esque sort of element.
Interesting. Well, that's fascinating. You were talking about how sometimes The Searchers can be written off as being racist. Mm. Sometimes people can project their own liberal utopian values all over it. That's the beauty of something like a Western. In fact, I pointing out a character like Mose, you're pointing out the complex approach it takes to the issue of racial integration. This film does get made in the wake of the Brown versus Board of Education desegregation of schools decision. It has been seen as a direct response to this, an analysis of this. Of course, the theme of assimilation versus integration versus conquering is throughout human history, and it will continue to be. It rears its head again around the globe right now, in this country right now. This character of Mose, what I love about it is he's the outsider. He's the outsider both for white society, and he's the outsider for the native society. And as such, he's both a source of ridicule and, oddly, someone who is respected in that he's allowed to remain free, he's allowed to remain alive, and he's ultimately the one whose word people in a strange way trust the most. Because in any society, it's the outsider who at times is capable of seeing things most clearly, because only from the outside can you connect the dots. If I can tie in earlier, I talked about how the film was an influence on David Lynch, and we would be remiss if we didn't point out that when Mose is called an old fool in The Searchers, his response is, "Thank you kindly." And then before that and after that, he whoops like an Indian. And both the "thank you kindly" and the whooping like an Indian are recreated by Hank Worden when he plays the world's most decrepit waiter in the TV series Twin Peaks. It's Lynch's way of paying direct homage to the influence the film had on him. he actually, at the end of a big scene with Kyle MacLachlan's character in a key sequence of Twin Peaks, he recreates the line and he recreates the whooping. So it's a fun doff of the cap.
Yeah. Other moments, again, in the movie is clearly replete with a whole range of these. John Wayne's son, Patrick, I think, makes a wonderful cameo performance as Lieutenant Greenhill. And I love the moment where Ethan Edwards effectively sort of gets the man to spin around and say, yes, I recognise you as a Yankee. Again, that reference that, you know, this still takes place within genuine living memory of that horrendous conflict that the Unionists versus the Confederates and so on, and the elements that work within that. But also, on a different line, the thing that for me is a wonderful development along the lines of Hitchcock's line that you actually get more impact from not showing something than actually showing something. You mentioned earlier, Phil, the original Homestead, and I think the shadow of Scar, obviously we see his face when he stands over Debbie and the funeral aspect there, the way in which the tension prior to that is built, and yeah. the sort of the recognition of what's actually happening. But in the same way, you also see the for me, very disturbing scene of the discovery in the latter part of the film of the deranged women, the women who effectively are seen at the fort, the portrayed by Ruth Clifford and so on, and the doll and the sort of notion. And the look, again, that we see on John Wayne's character, Ethan Edwards,
yes.
That clearly there's a loss.
It's the reaction among people who are alive yeah. that you're allowed to see. And it is what is so harrowing. I mean, really, I don't know if John Wayne has a finer moment on screen in his career when we see that really impressive display of rage and torment on his face. And it is still so powerful and really shocking. Having seen it many times before, it was shocking. Now, I must say, watching it on Blu-ray is quite the experience. Again, you get to see things a little more clearly, and some of these close-ups, you're getting to see things more than you did before. In fact, in one Calvary scene, I also saw a car driving by in the background. But I'm sure that was placed intentionally.
It was a time machine thing.
It was anachronistic.
Exactly. Yes.
the dying of the West and the coming of the automobile. No, I don't think so, because I think you can see someone flag the car down to let them know they're about to enter the shot. But
which again goes back to the notion that was one of the ways Ford worked, that when he had those wonderful speed, I mean, and that didn't use speed it up.
It is, you're right. It's the imposition of Henry Ford onto the work of John Ford. How right you are.
That did cross my mind as well, of course. we've talked about some of the more disturbing moments. When screening this to a group of our postgraduate students here, it was interesting getting their impact, because I think initially there was a reluctance to view this. And in terms of the schedule that we've used for the module, which is basically journalism and film, I wanted to actually guide through some of the kind of aspects of Hollywood to really give them a sort of sense of perspective. But the students were very much united in terms of their response, that they did feel that maybe viewed through the lens of our contemporary times, that in terms of political correctness, they did feel very uncomfortable with the way in which the Native Americans were being portrayed, especially, actually, the character of Martin Pawley's wife, Mrs. Pawley, and the sort of way in which not only she was Tret, but also the fact that clearly she lost her life. And there were the sort of issues where somehow, whilst one can appreciate it getting a laugh, and I think historically the biggest laugh for audiences for the cinema were basically when Wayne reveals, or Ethan Edwards reveals, that Martin Pawley has got himself a wife, when he thought he was actually just trading for information. But there was a kind of a sense of just concern about that. Now, I'm prepared to actually say, well, that's a cultural issue of the time from that perspective. Is it something which is worth dwelling on, or do we actually sort of say, well, okay, it was there. It was the way in which this was an era in which we hadn't thought about the Native Americans. We hadn't thought about the movement of land, etc. In fact, other than the noble savage and maybe the Last of the Mohicans or somebody like Tonto and the Lone Ranger, actually it was a very binary opposition. You had cowboys, the good guys, and Indians, the bad guys, and the cavalry would come and rescue us.
is this not a film about binary opposition? I mean, this is always the question, right? And having made a dark comedy now, you know, it is the laziest form of viewing to label a movie as being the same thing as the actions and attitudes it depicts, right? And so I see a movie that really is about binary opposition. I mean, everywhere we look, there seems to be two of everything. There's, you know, there's the two brothers who are in love with the same man. There's, how about the opening shot of as soon as Ethan walks in and he holds up Little Debbie, that will be mirrored by holding up Little Debbie when she's grown at the end. There's this binary. I was thinking about the binary opposition of Captain Sam Clayton. He's military and he's a reverend, right? 1950s America. This kind of competition during the birth of the military-industrial complex may be starting to take over from the control that faith-based organizations had, right? By 1960, we're going to have a Catholic president, the first time we've not had a Protestant. It was unthinkable to think we would ever have a Catholic president in this country. So it is about these binary oppositions, and the Civil War being the greatest symbol of binary opposition. And what does Ethan represent? You know, this mystery of Ethan's character, what does he represent? He represents someone who will neither win nor lose the binary. He wanders off somewhere else and gets rewarded for it. You know, there's that wonderful medal he's given that is often misinterpreted, right? The medal he gives to Debbie that will show up with Scar at the end, it's not a Confederate or a Union Army medal. It's a French medal awarded to mercenary soldiers who fought in 3 years, from 85 to 67, for the Emperor Maximilian of Mexico. So this medal implies that Ethan served in the French-Mexican expedition as an outsider during his mysterious absence, which also will explain his fluency in Spanish later in the film. So it's wonderful storytelling, but it also seems to me we get rewarded for stepping outside of the binary, much like Mose does. He steps out of the binary opposition. So I've gone far afield, I guess, in defending that the film is really about binary opposition, and to say that it is guilty of the evils of a binary way of looking at things is wrong, because that's what it's shining the light on. I would also point out that it's very much based on a real abduction story from, I think, 1835, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. And there are so many accounts. Lily Holloman actually played on stage one of these women who was abducted and made a wife of a native tribe in a play called Abundance. So there's a lot of literature, firsthand accounts of these things. So I would be very cautious at saying that the movie's depiction, again, of the wife was insensitive or unforgivable. Before we know whether or not it might have, in fact, been a very accurate depiction for the time. But in a larger sense, you know, I don't think we should ever let a work of art, nor do I think we should let, you know, people in history off the hook by saying, well, that's just what was done then. You know, we do believe, and I think we aspire to, hopefully, evolving into certain universal truths of what is right behavior and what is acceptable behavior and what is humane and compassionate behavior. So these are important questions to ask, but I think the movie is about these questions at the same time.
And possibly also, given obviously John Wayne's publicised latter views in terms of his own viewpoints, that maybe, again, you see this coloured through a different lens and so on. Let's move on to another brief consideration. Let's move on to Geoffrey Hunter. Again, clearly for those of us who appreciate The Cage and Star Trek and the fact that he was Christopher Pike and brought an agonising level of quality to that, as well as the oft maligned, not the greatest story ever told, but it was often sort of said as I was a teenage Jesus, King of Kings. Hunter's career, I mean, obviously ended tragically in a car accident at the end of it. Never quite managed to develop. And at this particular moment, there was a sense I got at one stage, maybe incorrectly, that actually he was of the era of potentially maybe even going down the route of James Dean, another tragic sort of star of the 1950s, a young actor. But his incarnation as Martin Pawley, he's very much the antithesis to Wayne's dogged determination character, and yet in his own way he's equally stubborn. He's stubborn to ensure that the message comes across, and again, in a hair-raising moment, we're going to listen to it in a few seconds, that moment where the reunion takes place. It's one of those areas where actually, again, I'd probably disagree with Ford on this if he said he didn't want music. I think this actually does need music. We'll talk about that again in another minute, just after we've had another selection from Max Steiner's original soundtrack and the reunion of Ethan Edwards and Debbie. Actually, I still defy anybody, if you've got an emotional bone in your body at all, not to actually have a goosebumps moment where you have the word "let's go home" in the dialogue. Let's go home.
You talked about Geoffrey Hunter and his work in King of Kings, which, right, being described, I was a teenage Jesus. And yet, it's just so unfair because he was 33 years old when he was cast to play Jesus, which was the same age as Jesus when he was crucified. Yeah. And so it couldn't be more appropriate. The only difference being Geoffrey Hunter was crucified for his youthful appearance and Jesus for his beliefs. Yeah. But anyway, it seems somehow very appropriate. I think it's a little bit of projection on my part, but when I see The Cage, when I see Geoffrey Hunter, and you're right, it is a career that feels like a gigantic what if, that feels like we were denied some great Geoffrey Hunter performances. And from what I gather, his wife was very much his manager and talked him into some very, very bad decision making as an actor. But in The Cage, there is some of that rage and torment, is there not? I mean, it really does seem like he is embodying someone who has been taken under the wing by John Wayne's Ethan, emotionally, and certainly maybe he learned something. I always find it interesting, what veteran actors, younger actors are paired with, and what maybe they take from them, and then years later, when it's called upon, they go, oh, I know what this looks like. I've had this modeled for me by another great actor. I found the same thing to be true in, 1980s, for example, Star Trek, and in 2000s, Boston Legal, where, boy, if William Shatner at times did not remarkably remind me of Spencer Tracy at different eras. And, of course, Spencer Tracy was William Shatner's hero, and they had worked together. So this kind of what these actors are capable of embodying, it does get, if not taught to them, it does get shown to to them. It does get modeled to them. But he is, he gives a very subtle and yet I think effective transformation as Martin Pauly. I think the optimist likes to view that there is really an arc that changes within Ethan's character in the film because of where he ends up and what he decides at the end and his slow, what wants to be seen as warming towards Martin. But I'm not sure that's true. I think he embodies pretty much rage and torment and regret the moment he shows up in that household, and then he still embodies it at the end, which is why there is no room for him in the household, and the story closes its door on him as an outsider left to wander, because those kind of primal emotions that are not only how he lives, but why he lives, there's no room for that in polite society. And so actually the arc and the movement is made, like I said, quite subtly through performance by Jeffrey Hunter. I think what really stood out to me on this viewing was how when he's first introduced, John Wayne's Ethan character says that he could pass for a half-breed, right? And Martin points out that he's one-eighth Cherokee. Yeah. Later in the film, John Wayne's character Ethan calls him a quarter Cherokee. Yeah. So I thought, oh, isn't this an interesting actual progression that he's becoming more assimilated? He's becoming more white in his and it works because you realize you've actually seen not only Marty grow up, but you see him growing up into a man of white society.
We've talked, obviously, about a range of items and aspects of the film. We're recording this particular podcast on International Women's Day. And again, I was speaking with some students about the role of women in certainly in the 60s and in television roles and so on, and the perception in the immediate pre-war period. But I actually raised the notion that there were some very strong female characters being presented in Hollywood, the Betty Davises, you mentioned Spencer Tracy, of course, Katharine Hepburn immediately springs to mind, and so on. As far as The Search is concerned, I think a nod of the hat to Laurie Jorgensen, portrayed by young Vera Miles, again demonstrating clearly, although there is an interesting line where the shot where she's seeing Martin Pauly fighting with fiancé,
yeah,
and taking a delight in this sort of battle, very primitive, primal sort of sequence from that point of view, but again, epitomising the notion of the frontier mentality, etc., and maybe, as you could almost argue, the nature view of, well, it's survival of the fittest.
Yes, it's that shot that you reference is unexpected, and in a different context would almost be frightening, wouldn't it? And I saw that shot, and I thought, oh, my goodness, does Hitchcock cast her in Psycho because of this moment?
Indeed.
Because this reveal is such a reveal, again, contextually different, but it's such a reveal the way that that Hitchcock would do it. Visually, something I would like to point out, that it's a little bit like putting the genie back in the bottle. But, you know, you talked about in The Cemetery, the introduction of Scar. There's the moment like that, the reveal of Vera Miles' reaction. How about the reveal of grown Debbie as one of the four wives to Scar, the way she rises behind Ethan and Marty in the tent, and the way she's introduced. There's just shot after shot after shot that have become almost cliche in their usage through the decades. So it's hard for a contemporary audience to realize this is where they started. This movie introduced all these signature visual motifs to us. And reminding myself of that was to be thrilled again by this movie. But one thing I will say about, obviously, if you're going to watch a Western, for the most part, unless it's a revisionist Western of the modern ilk, for the most part, there is a limitation in roles that actresses were going to play. This was not an actress-driven genre, though, as you pointed out, Hollywood of the 30s and 40s and even the 50s, there were many women's pictures. It was a great time for actresses in terms of the quality of roles, far better than the last 30 years, let's say, have been. But Westerns are the outlier, and it makes sense because there were a dearth of meaningful roles for women in Western society. Again, women represented the civilization that could only come once a certain kind of man had tamed the wild land. That said, The Searchers, and this is where the score is so important, and maybe one of the reasons that John Ford had ambivalence towards the score, there is a feminine presence throughout this film, an aspiration to a feminine presence, a feminine voice throughout it. I can't really put it into great words, but the music does that for us, and this kind of unspoken love and bond and fidelity that Ethan and Marty have for widely different reasons towards the deceased female family members.
And of course,
it's the heart of the movie. It drives the movie, and it's what prevents the movie from being a revenge piece. Mrs. Jorgensen, doesn't she chastise Ethan at one point and beg him not to let the young men throw their lives away in pursuit of vengeance? And it really doesn't become that. Even when they think they're seeking vengeance, the movie is not one about vengeance.
We're coming to the end.
It's about redemption in some way, some reunification of a family ideal.
We're beginning to come to the end of this exploration of some of the themes of The Searchers, but there are two final points I just want to actually raise. And again, they kind of speak of the layers that have been put in, which understandably you started off by talking about Cahiers du Cinéma, François Truffaut, the development of actually seeing the role of the director as being an auteur and a kind of visionary from a perspective of view. One is the love that clearly Ethan Edwards' character has for his brother's wife, the sort of forbidden love that we actually see, never reciprocated, but perfectly epitomised by the fond patting of his coat before he sort of goes off to investigate.
Right, not physically reciprocated.
Yes. Indeed.
But clearly reciprocated in what she embodies and what she expresses. Did you ever read the interview? I mean, and again, this is what an actor is pointing out, but Wayne said that he and John Ford spoke at length about the reality, and it certainly informs John Wayne's performance that he and Martha had been romantically involved and that the girls were his children.
Yeah. Which again,
that fuels his performance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other element, which again echoes to the closure and the element of Ethan Edwards, portrayed by Wayne as a character who ultimately does have to wander off again, is an aspect which Wayne himself talked about in terms of a very key physical aspect you take, where he actually caresses his elbow and just holds his elbow. And it's almost a suggestive of a sort of wound that's actually there, but then turns, and of course the door closes, and we go to the end credits. The fact that there's been a resolution, that Debbie has been restored after a fashion, age 15, after a decade, an epic has actually passed in terms of time. We've been to through different environments. We've been to Mexico. We've covered a whole range of aspects and characters and so on. But there is that notion that ultimately for Ethan Edwards, his role is done. His aspect then is presumably we're left to actually say, well, he becomes the wandering soul in essence.
I think it's an interesting hearing you speak about this, because of course there's a very personal reason why John Wayne does that. That was, as an actor, that was an homage to his favorite actor, Harry Carey, because that was the signature move, the signature physicality of actor Harry Carey, whose son, much like you pointed out, John Wayne's son, whose son is in The Searchers.
Yeah, as Brad Jorgensen.
Widow, Harry Carey's widow, Harry Carey died in 47, and Harry Carey's widow was on set when they shot that, and supposedly it was incredibly emotional for him to pay that tribute. But why that resonates so deeply, because the moment resonates, and this is the beauty of acting, this is the alchemical nature of acting, that you can connect with some very personal inspiration that will actually render the character in a very transpersonal and universal way. It is such an iconic image of the torment and the wounding and therefore and the way that he is closed out of the story. It is nothing less to me than all of these great Western storytellers saying, this closes the book on the mythological West. This is it. We've done it. We have been telling these Western stories far longer than the Old West itself existed, and this is the capper of it. And from this point forward, to a degree, all Westerns, including John Ford's, when you think of Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, these will be revisionist Westerns that seek to point out the difference between the history and the legend. But this is where the legend ends. And that's what really struck me at this point. If I may make one other observation about the relevancy of this movie today. Again, the hatred, the intense burning rage and hatred that Ethan has for the Comanche Indians, for Indians in general, for natives in general, it would seem, but especially for the Comanche, what struck me at the same time is that the character that hates them the most is also the character with the greatest knowledge of their culture, which I found fascinating, as opposed to our contemporary culture, where the most hateful rhetoric and attitudes tend to come from people who know the least about the cultures that they are attacking or opposing. But time and again, it is Ethan himself who knows what things mean to the people that he is pursuing. And again, that is such an interesting binary opposition in the film, because we're always taught, right, that that racism and xenophobia and animosity and hostility comes from a lack of intimacy with the other. And yet Ethan embodies intimacy with the source of his animosity. It's fascinating, it's troubling, it's really, really dark. It, again, it hints at the rage that creates so many of these myths of the Old West.
If time allowed, and who knows, we may actually revisit this with our colleagues Randy Reinholtz and Gene Bruce Scott from the Native American Voices and get their view, because, again, another issue which we don't really have time to go into is Henry Brandon, obviously not a Native American actor, portraying Scar. I think one or two critics were still concerned that maybe we could have had a change with respect to the casting, but that is another argument for another day and another time. I think.
Do we have enough time in the closing to talk about the Bat Cave just real quick?
Go.
Because I love, you know, I live walking distance from there. I love that in the climactic sequence, this is what they mean by the magic of the movies. Ethan gets off his horse in Monument Valley, climbs over a little ridge chasing after Debbie, and suddenly he's here in Hollywood at the Bronson Caves, and he literally picks Debbie up into his arms in the Bat Cave. Filmmaking still goes on there to this day.